Protest music has been the soundtrack for some of America's most significant struggles. Civil rights reform, the push for workers' rights, and anti-war efforts, to name a few. Now Americans are once again taking to the streets. Moms and sisters, scientists, students, protesting has become popular. Some would say necessary once again. But what about protest music? As American activism experiences a great awakening, is there a corresponding interest in music that speaks to the struggle? And more personally, from the artist's perspective, do they feel pressure to join the public discussion through their art and their craft? Joining me are two musicians, both with perspectives on the appetite and need for protest music now. Billy Bragg is a bona fide protest singer who's raised his voice for many causes and issues, international and domestic, here in America. As far as I can tell, he's the loudest voice in protest music, and he has been for decades. He joins us via Skype from the UK. Welcome, Billy.
Welcome. How's Sean? Good to be here.
And in our Woods Hole studio is Ryan Momplew, a singer-songwriter from this area of the world and a part of the American jam band scene, playing around 200 dates a year in venues of all sizes across the country. You're playing, I think, Carnegie Hall on Friday, Ryan?
I am. I'm singing at Carnegie this Friday.
Well, welcome to The Point, Ryan.
Good to be here. Thanks, Sean.
I do want to talk a little about the history of protest music in American culture, but let's start with the right now. Billy Bragg, as someone who for 30 years has attracted audiences interested in protest music and issue-oriented music, would you say people are becoming even more interested because of things like Brexit and the Trump presidency?
I think they are, most certainly. I was just a couple of weeks ago at Folk Alliance International Conference in Kansas City, Missouri, which goes on every year and has been going on for, I think, maybe 10 years now. But particularly this year, there was a real focus on music with something to say. And that's great for people from my generation and the generation before me. There were people there like Tom Paxton, who was part of the folk boom in the 1960s. But for a younger generation of songwriters, they seem to be connecting with what we were doing, what we were talking about, and particularly what the generation before me had been doing. I was really encouraged by that. You know, the folk scene has always been interested in topical songs. And for sometimes topical song hasn't been fashionable, but the folk fans have kind of kept it alive. That's one of the great things about being part of the folk scene. And I kind of vaguely fit into the folk scene because I'm solo on a player guitar. So they've been nurturing the political idea for a long, long time. And I think they feel ready to come back roaring.
Ryan Momplew, your perspective, you've been touring the U.S. annually for 15 years. Are you hearing more protest music in the venues where you're performing?
I don't know. I'm certainly hearing a need for it. And certainly, you know, I'm walking the worlds of people conveying their truth. And if you're conveying your truth, you're certainly reflecting what's going on out there. But I agree with Billy. Like, from my personal perspective, I'm a guy who kind of fits in a tangential way into the folk world. I fit into other worlds too, but because I'm a guy with an acoustic guitar and a voice and for reflecting my truth, I'm in the folk world. And I certainly respect in those worlds, in quiet rooms, you know, those perspectives I think are encouraged more. And in other scenes, you know, people just want to kind of get away.
So are we talking about maybe artists who never really went in this direction before, perhaps considering it now? Billy, what do you think?
I think we're more talking about a generation that doesn't have a background in ideological politics, trying to get to grips with issues that are no longer easily defined as left and right. I mean, so many things have changed since the 1980s when I was making music, most obvious of which would be the end of the Cold War, the collapse of the Berlin Wall, the disappearance of an ideological framework with which to talk about politics, and the rise of Trump and to some extent Brexit as well are kind of outside of that clear left-right divide, because at the root of the impulse, I believe, for people, particularly working class people who voted for Trump and for Brexit, is a dissatisfaction with globalized capitalism. Hmm. You know, they feel that their voices are no longer heard. They feel that their towns are no longer succeeding, that jobs have been moved abroad. And, you know, this is a critique that informed us in the 1980s during the miners' strike. But it's changed out of all shape to be able to try and get a handle on it in ideological terms, the way that we used to. And I think that's made it more difficult for young bands who haven't had that background to be able to be taken seriously. Because I think if you've got a framework around which to discuss something, then everybody from the smallest website fanzine to the New York Times is going to respect what you're talking about, because you're talking within a common framework. Because that's disappeared, I think young bands don't have the confidence to feel that they will be taken seriously by mainstream media and by commentators. And obviously we know that the price for not being taken seriously nowadays is much, much higher than it was in the 80s for me. I only had to put up with people writing letters to the New Musical Express. Now, if you, you know, if you say something online that's a bit, you know, not fully formed or argumentative, you can just get flamed. And I can understand why young artists might think twice before putting their head above the parapet.
Absolutely. I would definitely agree with that. And I think nowadays it's much more... There's not two sides, there's millions of sides, or billions of sides, however you want to call it. That's just so, it's so apparent these days. And I think, yeah, exactly, given the nature of the way things are online, and everybody giving their two cents, everybody giving you a review constantly, 24 hours a day. For me, it's helped me to build up my thick skin on those kinds of things and find my voice over the years and continue to dig down and keep telling my truth. To just really try to make some sense out of all this wave of stuff that's going on.
Because back in the day, there were many points of view as well, but we were broadly talking about something in a common language, the language of it was the language of Marx at the time. And we were talking about it because we believed in a cause. Now you're having to deal with guys who are only doing it for the lulz. They have no parameters. They have no... position that they're rigidly defending. They are moving all the time. You can never really pin them down. And that's most dispiriting when you're trying to discuss ideas online that you feel passionate about. So the peoples who feel strongly about these causes are not able to get purchase on them in the way that we used to. It was just as complicated back then, but it was more straightforward as an artist to say something, because music played a vanguard role in youth culture, which it doesn't play anymore.
I want to play Billy Bragg's interpretation of a song called The Internationale. The song traditionally has been a political and workers' anthem going back to the late 1800s. But Billy, you revised it, you wrote new words, but you did this 25 years ago. And before we play it, can you kind of tell us how this revision came about?
Sure. I was at the Vancouver Folk Festival in the chow tent, the artist chow tent, when Pete Seeger came and sat down opposite and invited me to come and sing with him at the end of his show on Sunday night and the closing show of the festival. He was going to sing the Internationale in solidarity with the students in Tiananmen Square, which was happening at the time we were there. And he wanted me to sing the English language version, which I said to him was really archaic, and I didn't think the lyrics meant anything anymore. And so he said, well, why don't you write some new lyrics for it? You've got 24 hours. And in folk music, there's some people you can't say no to, and old Pete was one of them.
Yeah.
So I went off and did my homework and sang a verse, and it kind of worked okay. But at the within 12 months, the Soviet Union was gone, and so much of our socialist culture seemed to be going into the dumpster, and nobody seemed to be able to work out which was baby and which was bathwater, to mix my metaphors. So I thought it might be a good idea to try and update the Internationale so that it survived the end of the Cold War. And I'm pleased to say that my lyrics now are next to the original lyrics in the IWW Little Red Songbook. It's like that's like an Oscar in folk music now.
Sure it is. Let's listen to some of those lyrics.
Victims of oppression, for the tyrants fear your might. Don't cling so hard to your possessions, for you have nothing if you have no rights. Let racist ignorance be ended, for respect makes the empires fall. Freedom is merely privilege extended unless enjoyed.
Tonight. build walls to divide us. Walls of hatred, nor walls of stone. Come greet the dawn and stand beside us. We'll live together or we'll die alone. In our world poisoned by exploitation. No...
Billy, you were probably referring to the Berlin Wall when you wrote that. But it's kind of like hearing, you know, as you listen to this now, as America's talking about building a new border wall and making Mexico pay for it. What do you think about those lyrics all these years later?
Well, I mean, obviously, I stand by everything I said, but that's the trouble with writing topical songs. They remain topical. I mean, there are songs that Woody Guthrie wrote 80 years ago. You could sing them now and they have just as much meaning. I mean, I've been singing the last couple of years. I've been singing, I ain't got no home in this world anymore. You know, and the homeless situation of homeless people, both in Europe and in North America, it still resonates. Those songs still resonate. And I think that's the power of music. It retains its power and suddenly a song, you know, there's a song I'm currently playing, which is called Why We Build the Wall, written by a songwriter from Vermont, Anais Mitchell. Now, she wrote that song as part of an opera that she wrote called Hadestown about Orpheus in the underworld. And yet when I saw her sing that at Occupy London in 2011, it seemed to me to be about the divisions in Europe, and the immigrants trying to get into our country to find work. And it's a song I've been singing the last couple of years, and it just gets more and more powerful the more I sing it. Donald Trump's plans to build a wall on the Mexican border have just seemed to supercharge the song when I play it now. And that's how topical song works.
And, of course, you mentioned Woody Guthrie. He wrote This Land Is Your Land, which is now, you know, a part of the American songbook. But that has deep roots as a protest song.
It does, and it has verses which talk about poverty and the ownership of land. You know, Woody knew what he was talking about. And the good thing about Woody was he never wrote a cynical song in his life. And I think that's really, really important because, you know, there's too much cynicism out there. The internet has become like an open sewer of cynicism. And we have to fight against our own cynicism. Those of us on the left who want to make the world a better place, we have to be very, very careful that we don't allow ourselves to descend into cynicism, because cynicism is it's the opposite of what we should be promoting in our songs, which I think fundamentally, whatever you're writing about, music is fundamentally a way of transmitting empathy between people who've never met, about situations you've never heard of, and making a connection on an emotional level by making people feel something for someone they've never met.
How does that statement resonate with you, Ryan Montbleu?
Yeah, I could not agree more with that. I mean, that's the part where I feel confident as a writer, and I feel like that's my role, is to bring people together and to you know, make sure that I don't lose the humanity in sort of quote unquote the other side, or in people who didn't vote the way I did, or just, you know, people who come from different places that I come from. I have to find the connection there and keep the humanity there and not just vilify and fight against.
And interestingly, that seems to be one of the things that people like Milo Yiannopoulos is absolutely opposed to, any form of empathy. When you hear him talking about virtue signaling and political correctness and trying to knock down any expression of fellow feeling, they're afraid of it. And I think the reason why they're afraid of it is because they know that if you mix apathy with action, you get solidarity. And that's what they're most afraid of. Solidarity of people coming together to take them on. So I think that's why they're constantly trying to undermine any expression of compassion between people, particularly from people from different cultural or ethnic backgrounds. They're really afraid of that. That's why we should be promoting it with our music.
My guests are singer-songwriters Billy Bragg and Ryan Montbleu. We're talking about protest music, the artists who write and perform it, as well as its role in culturally and politically these raucous times. When we get back, we're going to hear Ryan Montbleu sing. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Point. I'm your host, Sean Corcoran. We're talking with Billy Bragg and Ryan Montbleu, singer-songwriters, and we're discussing protest music. And Ryan, you have a good perspective on what's happening in American music, and while you don't consider yourself a protest singer per se, you wrote and recorded a song called Thick American Skin, which also references immigration, which we were talking about just a few minutes ago. I could play the recording, but I asked if you would sing it live, so thank you for doing that. But before you do, tell us how you kind of came to this song, Thick American Skin.
Well, I wrote it during the George W. Bush years, and I mean, it's almost strange to look back at that now. Now seems like, I mean, maybe it's because we're in the present, but everything seems so much more heightened now, and the sort of the side against side and the hatred, I can, it, to me, is even spewing more nowadays. But those were some intense years, and you know, post 9/11 and sort of George W. plunging us into war in Iraq, and to oversimplify things, you know, like, so there's, I mean, my job is to reflect truth. I don't, again, yeah, like you said, I don't consider myself a protest singer, but if I'm, but I'm an artist, and I, if I'm reflecting truth, then I'm reflecting what's going on. So that's what I was trying to do then. And I was also touring the country quite a bit then. And, you know, and you see, it sort of, it levels the playing field in a way. You see people as people and not just like this, this conglomeration of red states and blue states. I mean, the, you know, the country's purple, really.
Let's hear you sing Thick American Skin.
Thanks.
The colors of my country, the colors of a bruise, with 50 stars to signify that no one's born to lose. And the gifts that we've been given come bestowed by tired hands, tied to no known race, religion, or native of this land. And I am falling into a freedom trail, high as any mountain range as yet unknown. And I am falling into a freedom cheer now, celebrating all the many things that I hold dear. So I celebrate this freedom, and I celebrate my home, and I celebrate this fenced-in land that we are standing on. Oh, I celebrate and celebrate, and I celebrate again, and I use this day to celebrate my thick American skin. Meanwhile, the fate of all the world is knocking at the door, and we say, this is private property, don't come round here no more. And we are falling into a freedom trail, deep as any gold mine as yet unshown. And we are falling into a freedom fear now, afraid of losing all the many things that we hold dear. The colors of my country, the colors of a bruise, and a big bloody mess to glorify the red, the white, the blue. And these fights that we are fighting, our fear will help no future day, and only hinder Lady Liberty as she wanders on her way. No, these fights that we are fighting, I fear, will help no future day, and only hinder all of us as we wander on our way. May we please not hinder Lady Liberty wandering on her way.
Ryan, how do people react to that song?
Well, I haven't performed it as much in the recent years until about now, since the GW years, you know. And I think, I definitely got some strong reactions. People still ask me for that song, people who really resonates with, and I've also gotten adverse reactions. I remember singing that song during those years I was playing on the 4th of July in a public park in Park City, Utah, as part of, like, it was a gig we were doing, it was a big show kind of in the park. And I sang that song, and a guy, an older man, came up, he was livid at the end of the show and said, this is no place for a protest song. And I'm thinking, you know, in a public park on the 4th of July in America, I'd say this is a pretty good place for a song, and where I was just speaking the truth. And again, in that song, I'm not sort of denouncing, this needs to come down. I'm speaking my truth about, you know, kind of the hurt and mixed with the pride I feel for my country. And that was an interesting situation.
Billy, maybe you can talk a little about that, the act of performing songs, sometimes singing songs that have a protest aspect to them. That takes courage, right?
It does. Although being told not to sing a revolutionary song on July the 4th, that takes some that takes some rethinking around it. I think celebration of a revolutionary moment there.
I agree.
I think what the question is, how you define a protest song. You know, I think that there's... it's a much maligned phrase. And when I speak to young artists who are talking about writing what we might call protest songs, I'm always telling them to really, it's not really about writing about politicians. It's writing about the pressure that you feel under. That's what I want to hear. How does that manifest itself? What pressures led Ryan to write those words? And I think they were brilliant lyrics, by the way, Ryan, particularly the first line where you talk about your country. It sounded very much like a Phil Oakes song to me. I mean, Phil was one of those people who felt very strongly about his country in a patriotic way. You know, a patriot in the way that Woody was a patriot, in the way that Pete Seeger was a patriot, that they stood up for not just for the idea of the country, but for the Constitution that guarantees the rights of every American citizen. So I thought that resonated in that way as well. And I think that really, ultimately, the opportunity to say something other than just what everybody else is saying. I mean, that's everyone's got to have a USP. And at the moment, being able to talk about something that everybody's talking about, you can't avoid Trump in your country. You can't avoid Brexit in my country. To walk out on stage and pretend it's not happening, you must be on drugs.
Mm-hmm. About 2 weeks ago, Billy Bragg gave the keynote address at the Folk Alliance International Conference in Kansas City. And in that speech, he spoke to the next generation of folk singers, talking about the folk tradition and music's power to charge people up. I want to ask Billy about that speech and what he was up to. But first, Ryan, you actually brought the speech to my attention as a member of that next generation. What did you take away from Billy Bragg's words to the Folk Alliance?
Well, there was a lot. I thought it was so poignant, and I guess the idea of solidarity, the idea of empathy, and overcoming our own cynicism, I think, was really just such a strong message to come away from that with. Certainly, empathy and solidarity, and bringing people together as opposed to dividing.
And Billy Bragg, what were you up to? Who was your audience? What was your message?
Music can't change the world. We have to start there. We can't pretend that it was music that changed things in the 1960s. You know, Martin Luther King didn't march to Selma because Bob Dylan wrote "The Times They Are Changing." It's the other way around. But that doesn't mean that you can't try and give a different perspective with your music. So what I was hoping to do by talking about those kind of sort of broad brush ideas like empathy and solidarity, I was trying to break it down to what I really thought was happening based on my experience of playing political gigs over the last 40 years, if you include my time in a punk band, and trying to express that to a younger generation so that they weren't trying to rewrite the times they are changing, that they're actually trying to write from their own experience, that it's in language that they can get a handle on. You know, it would have been so wrong for me to make an ideological speech there because half the audience below the age of 40 wouldn't have understood it. So instead I was trying to get to those things that we all know, those of us who make music, those things that we all know in our hearts are true about what we're trying to do, about empathy, about solidarity, about not giving in to cynicism, that we're the people who utilize all those skills and all those abilities to try and break down the kind of narrow-minded mentality that we're seeing both expressed through Brexit in my country and through the election of Donald Trump in the United States.
One important point of discussion ongoing is about the reliability of news stories and sources. It's certainly a big discussion here in the United States right now. Some media institutions do take sides, of course, and President Trump continues to attack the U.S. press. Tell me, Ryan and Billy, where do you guys get your news? How do you keep yourself informed so you can engage on these issues?
I read as many sources as I can, but I mean, I've weeded through what I consider really biased sources online. I mean, everything comes online these days, you know, like I'm really reading actual print, but I read, you know, I certainly read the New York Times, and I will check out CNN. I will check out, I mean, it's coming from all directions.
Billy?
One of the good things about Twitter is it allows you to follow activists who are, some of them are 40 years younger than you, voices that you wouldn't hear reading the same old newspapers you've always read, where the correspondents are of a similar age and a similar generation to you. So I there's people I follow online, you know, particularly women who have a perspective that's in some ways come after the sort of socialist ideas that I came with, you know, ideas about feminism, ideas about identity in a sexual sense, those kind of issues that I didn't grow up talking about. I pick it up off following people. Twitter, I find, is very good for that. But generally, as Ryan was saying, it's out there. You kind of our job really is to join the dots that everybody can see in a way that is different from the way it's being done by the mainstream media, so that we're not putting forward lies. We're just putting forward a different perspective that challenges people's idea about the way the world is. And music used to be able to do that much more in the 1960s because it was the only social medium that was available to young people. Now, obviously, there's lots and lots of different social mediums out there, so it's become more dissipated. So it will never be as culturally vibrant as it was in the 60s music, but it still has a very important role to play, I believe.
I believe so too. And I think the role of an artist in general is to connect things. That's like kind of what we do. And there's so many dots to connect these days. And I would also back up the fact that I think Twitter's come on pretty strong for me personally lately in terms of a really kind of streamlined feed of all kinds of interesting voices that you want to follow and educated voices. And so that's
although I'll be perfectly honest, sometimes I don't press refresh. I'm like, you know what? I've had enough of this today.
It's enough.
I've put so much time in my day for this.
Mm-hmm. Agreed.
Billy Bragg, you brought up Phil Oakes a few minutes ago, and he was able to make a living as essentially a full-time protest singer. In fact, for a time in the 60s and 70s, protest music was an offshoot of popular music, as you were saying. Is that something you think could happen again in 2017 in this new wave of activism, or is it simply kind of not possible with the way the music business is structured now?
I don't think it's the way the music business is structured. I think it's the way that people have to express their feelings about the world. When I was 19, which was in 1977, there was only one medium available for me if I wanted to talk about the way the world was. That was to learn to play guitar, write songs, and do gigs. As a result of that, all of the debates that young people had went on through music, whether it's politics, relationships, fashion, everything. It went on in the music papers. We dressed like our musical heroes. We carried albums around. It was very visible. It was, although we didn't realize it, it was our one social medium. Now, if you're angry about the world and you're 19, you've got a number of options. You can, you know, start a website, make a film on your camera, Facebook pages, Twitter. So more people will be able to express their views, which is a positive thing, but it's become very, very dissipated. The audience isn't all in one place like it was in the 60s and 70s. And so I think that the thing that music has to offer that you can't get on the internet is bringing people together in one place. It's the communion of the live gig. And there's a lot of solidarity in those experiences where you're standing together with people, singing a song that you love. Everyone's singing it at the top of their voices. The person who wrote it is singing it, whether it's a love song or a political song or whatever. You get a feeling of support from that. You know, whatever feelings you've invested this song with, you are immediately justified by the fact everyone's singing it. So that has both an emotional sense, but also it can have a political sense as well, because you can play these songs and leave that town and let the audience members feel that they're not the only people in the world who care about this stuff. And I think that's a very, very important role. You don't kind of get that on the internet.
Absolutely. Music moves you viscerally, and that's part that can never be discounted, I think, in this medium at all. You can exactly get people into a room and move them from the inside out. Bob Dylan, "It's All Right, Ma, I'm Only Bleeding." That, for me, is such a visceral, it's like it's not like he's being overtly, like, calling anyone out by name. That's like just a force of what I consider a protest song. Anyway, that's it.
It's the pressure. It's the pressure that he was under at the time. He's coming out in that song.
Yeah.
You know, and that's what it's about. It's about the pressure. It's not about the politicians. Just the pressure. I think that's what young people should be writing about. I want to hear the pressure that in my country, they're going to be the first people to grow up poorer than their parents.
Yeah.
I want to hear about
the pressure.
And I don't care what form of music it is. It doesn't have to be white boys with guitars. It doesn't have to be punk rock.
Yeah.
It could be any old form you like. I mean, I don't know if you know Hooray for the Riff Raff, which is a young woman from New York.
Yeah, they're great.
Named Alinda Segarra. She's Puerto Rican. I mean, she's been making interesting music for a while, but her most recent songs are clearly reflecting the change in attitude towards immigrants that's come with the Trump ascendancy.
Said you're gonna shoot me down, put my body in the river. Shoot me down, put my body in the river while the whole world sings. Sing it like a song, the whole world sings. Like there's nothing going wrong. He shot her down, he put her body in the river. He covered her up, but I went to get her and I said, my girl, what happened to you now? I said, my girl, we gotta stop it somehow.
And it's you know, from these interesting places, these interesting dynamics that the new music is going to come. It's not going to be like we thought, like it was in the 60s. You know, it's going to be a new way. People have new formats and new ways of doing it. But it is out there. Just because we can't see the new Bob Dylan doesn't mean it's not happening.
Right.
Absolutely.
I think that's all the time we have. I want to thank my guest, Billy Bragg, who joined me from the UK. Thank you, Billy, for your insight today. Appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you very much, Sean. Thank you, Ryan, for singing.
Thank you, Billy.
Thanks, yeah, Brian Montbleu, thank you for sharing your music and your stories. For WCAI and The Point, I'm Sean Corcoran.